The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
On today's show, we're going to tackle some additional Social Security questions and some other retirement-related questions, as we normally do here on the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. It's a little different than our EDU show, where we tend to delve deep into one particular topic. On today's show, we let you, the listeners, decide what we cover, and you decide by sending us email questions, or in some cases on the show, when we have live listeners, we'll take live phone calls. Today we're going to be just taking or trying to whittle down the pile of email questions that we have. My name is Chris Stein. I'm here with Jim Saulnier as well. He's got the pile in front of him, so he hasn't let me know what the first question topic might be, but I'm almost positive we've still got several Social Security-style questions in there. So among other things, we'll definitely be tackling some more of those Social Security questions. So.
We do, but we are... good evening, folks, or good morning, good evening, good day. Depends what time they're listening. I keep forgetting that this isn't an organized show. Well, I mean, it's not organized.
It's not organized either,
that. But it can play at any time. It's whenever somebody wants to listen to it. It's not an organized time that you listen to it, and it's certainly not an organized show half the time. I think our listeners can tell that. If they actually saw what this looked like, first of all, the recording studio with this desk and the mess on it, but how literally I was downstairs working, had to run upstairs so we could start recording this, and then in about another 45 minutes, I have to go back downstairs to take a call. I don't think people appreciate the fact that we're an actual living, breathing, practicing financial planning office.
We're not just radio folks, I guess.
Hell no.
Or TV personalities.
If we were radio folks, we'd have a well-produced, choreographed.
Produced. Yeah.
I was going to say
corrugated. We'd have all those fancy
things. But I knew it wasn't corrugated.
We'd have producers. We'd have high-tech equipment. We'd have,
We'd have one of those rooms where the people who work for us are behind glass and we can't hear them unless they press a button.
Right, but we can send signals to have them go get us coffee and things.
Yes.
Yeah.
But we don't have any of that.
No, we don't.
We're up in the attic of our studio. As we renovated the attic, and we sit in the attic. But it's crazy here at times, and today it definitely is crazy because we just have an awful lot going on. Everyone is trying to squeeze in tax planning before the end of the year.
Yep.
And this time of year just drives us nuts. But so we're just very busy. But we are taking time out of our very busy day to answer some questions here on the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A version. I am Jim Saulnier, a certified financial planner. That other fine voice you hear with mine is Chris Stein, a finance instructor. Actually, you are now director.
of the financial planning program.
The financial planning program at Colorado State University and a certified financial planner. Much better pedigree than I have.
A lot more words, yes.
Yeah, you could take up the whole front end of a business card with that.
Easily.
So we do this once a week, two different shows, one where we answer your questions, another where we drill down into a little bit more depth. If anybody has any questions pertaining to retirement planning, IRAs, 401ks, required minimum distributions, Social Security, anything of that ilk, don't hesitate to send us an email. There's no guarantee your question will be answered in a timely fashion. We are going to answer one email that literally came in today. I'm going to answer that first thing. But don't expect that type of attention.
Is that a question from your mom? So you got to get
She's
right.
the only one with that kind of pull. Yeah. Mom, a mom question gets answered right away.
Right to the top of the list.
Exactly. No, this is on the 60-day rollover show we did, which is...
And since time is running out for the year, we need to talk about that one.
I need to talk about that one. Okay. But if anybody else has a question they'd like to get to, at some point in time, we will get to it. That I can certainly say. That could be as little as a few hours, as this one I'm about to answer, to... months and months and months in some cases. But what you can do is go to our website, Jim Helps. That's jimhelps.com. Click on the Contact Us button. You can send us an email right from that form that opens up. If you don't want to do it that way and you want to do it a more organic way, you simply type in the address bar of an email, jim@jimhelps.com. That's my email address, jim@jimhelps.com. Send us your email question and we will answer it on the radio. Okay, once again, Chris, that November 21st show on using a 60-day rollover as a way of, it doesn't really mimic or replicate a recharacterization, a Roth recharacterization. Instead, what I'm trying to get people to understand is it merely gives you a little bit more time.
It buys you some time.
To honestly figure out what your tax situation looks like so you can figure out with a little bit more surety in your calculation about how much you might want to convert. Well, in the past, it was really easy. Chris and I used to love this. We would just literally tell everyone, convert as much as you want. We used to give the analogy of a baker measuring a cup of flour, would take that cup and scoop it into a big vat of flour, purposefully overflowing that cup to scrape a butter knife across the top of that cup and get exactly a cup. Well, that's how we used to do Roth conversions in the past, if you remember, Chris. If we wanted to completely fill the 15% bracket, which is now 12%, or the 22% bracket that used to be 25 going back to last year.
Only a year,
And
seems like eons ago.
It will be back to 25 in 2026. But if you wanted to fill a bracket, we used the same analogy. We would say purposefully overfill your bracket with conversion by converting as much as you want. And the literal euphemism of our butter knife was a Roth recharacterization. You would figure out the exact amount the following year when you were doing your taxes that you should have converted. You would have done a recharacterization to move the difference back to an IRA, being left with the perfect cup of flour in our example. Well, those days are gone.
It was a beautiful world.
It was a beautiful world. Those days are gone. So we have a show, in case you're just listening to us, you don't know what the hell I'm talking about. We did a show on November 21st on using a 60-day rollover as a substitute, but not a replacement to the Roth conversions, which were outlawed beginning in 2018.
Well, the recharacterizations were outlawed. Conversions we can still
That's
do.
That's right. You can still do the conversions. But I misspoke.
But the date requirement, date is December 31st of the year you want the conversion to count. And that's where the difficulty lies. By December 31st, people usually don't know their full tax situation because they haven't gotten all the tax documents for that particular tax year. So you're kind of in the dark when you're trying to figure out how to perfectly fill a tax bracket if that's your goal. And so this technique that Jim described is a way of buying some time. It doesn't buy you as much time as the old recharacterization did. You had lots and lots of time there, probably more than anyone could ever need. But this is a short amount of time, but way better than the alternative, which is to try to guess at your tax situation as of December 31st or even before that. You really can't time it as of December 31st because of the holidays and the functional steps that have to happen for the conversion to take place. You're usually doing it before that. So Jim's recommended method bought you essentially 60 days approximately in order to get a clarity on your tax situation. And it's prompted a few questions, and this must be one of those
questions. It has, it has. And I know because another listener sent me a link to it. It's being bantered about on a blog hosted by Fidelity Now referencing our show and the recording of it and talking about here's a strategy people can do. So I want to make sure people are following it. And I know on the show we pointed out to people jokingly saying with a strong degree of truth to it, don't try this at home.
It's easy to screw up.
Yes. If you are not meticulous with an attention to detail and you can easily reach or follow deadlines, if you can't follow deadlines, in other words, and you don't have an attention to detail and you're not meticulous, don't do this because you're going to mess it up. And if you mess it up, you're going to be stuck on hand with a very big distribution from your IRA. And you're not going to be very happy on that at all.
Correct.
Goodness. Okay. So we got this question in today. Mm-hmm. I jumped it to the top of the line because we have to, if you're going to do this, it has to be done by the end of the year. And it's already December something today.
December 3rd when December we're 3rd. Recording this.
Oh, so. Where's the month going?
Where all the other months go.
To Never Never Land.
One step forward for us towards the grave.
And this plays on, what, the 6th? No, third, fourth, about the 9th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So by the time this is being rebroadcast on the podcast, you're going to have maybe a couple of weeks
to
pull this off.
Okay. So it begins, and this is a person calls himself George from Virginia, not Georgia.
Nice.
George from Virginia. Okay. He says, hi, Jim and Chris. Thank you for the November 21st blog on the 60-day rollover technique for better nailing your desirable Roth conversion within the tax bracket. So he's trying to do exactly mm-hmm. what we were trying to say.
Yep.
Fill his tax bracket. Fill that cup of flour. He has two questions, though. When you describe the letters to be written to the custodians, and one thing I want to point out, if you're a new listener and you don't know what we're talking about, listen to that November 21st show. We don't want to really rehash a lot of what we cover on the show. When you describe the letters to be written to the custodian, didn't you mean that the rollover was for 2018 and not 2017, as stated in timestamp 33.25 into the iTunes version of the podcast? Excuse me. I never went back and listened to that because I didn't have time. I am guessing we misspoke and said 2017 instead of a 2018 conversion. I don't see...
Depends on if I didn't... This is the first time I'm hearing this, so I didn't have a chance to go back and listen to it either. If we were talking about having done it back then, the old way, back in 2017, that was one issue. Because if you did it in 2017, you can just... You're under the old rules, and you can recharacterize. You can't now, because you only had until October 15th of 2018 to do that. So I don't recall from the timestamp. Wouldn't that be a weird brain I'd have to be able to recall what we were talking about in the word in the timestamp?
Yeah. We'd have
but
to
we
go
probably
back.
Did misspeak. If we were talking about doing it the new way, we'd be using an example from 2018 that would then trickle or kind of linger on into the beginnings of 2019 before the 60-day rollover had to be finalized.
Right, and what we're trying to do with these letters, because his whole question is about the letters. So on the first one, we very well may have misspoke and got the dates messed up, 2017, 2018, I don't know. Very rarely do I listen to the podcasts again, but if I have nothing going on, I will try to listen to that and get to that timestamp and see what we were talking about.
I usually only go back and re-listen when someone's sent an email saying, hey, there's something wrong with the recording at 14-minute mark or something.
Well, there
like
could
that.
Be something wrong. We very well may have. But what I want to talk about, what is the letter and what's the whole point of it? The letter we talk about is called the letter of instruction. It is just, it can be handwritten, it can be typed. Doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be a formal letter. It doesn't have to be a business letter.
No.
It is just telling the custodian what you are doing. We suggested strongly the money that you direct into a Roth IRA, you would attach a letter of instruction saying specifically what this is. And if it was money that was going back into your traditional IRA as a 60-day rollover and not a conversion, because remember, the money going into the Roth is a conversion. So you would attach these letters of instruction. The whole point of the letter of instruction, honestly, folks, is to CYA you.
Right, I was going to say the same thing.
Not necessarily the custodian. Because if the custodian makes a mistake or you get a letter audit, and chances are you will get a letter audit on this, because there's going to be money flying around, money coming out of the IRAs, going into your bank account. From the bank account, some is going into a Roth, some is going into your regular IRA, but you're getting a 1099 for the whole amount, and you're only paying taxes on a certain amount. The IRS is going to want to know what the heck is going on,
right.
And they're going to send you a letter audit. As you make your case in the letter audit, and if most people have never been letter audited, so many of our clients have been letter audited, Chris, we just know what they look like and how they're handled. And you have to put your data, your documentation together. And we help our clients do that. Put it all together. Put them, you actually include a letter of instruction with the letter audit referencing different exhibits. Exhibit 1, that packet is this. Exhibit 2, that packet is this. Exhibit 3, that packet is this. And you outline why you feel the IRS is wrong, because the letter audit tries, convicts, and sentences you. They're going to essentially say, hey, we saw this. Let's just say you tried this 60-day rollover technique with $100,000 to pull a big number. So the IRS is getting this great big juicy 1099 for $100,000 coming out of your IRA, and they think they're going to get taxes on that, and then they look at your 1040 and they see $30,000. I'm just making these numbers up. $30,000 on your 1040 you're declaring as income. Well, that's going to throw up a red flag to the IRS. Mm-hmm. They're not going to haul you in. Those days are over. Their computer's just going to send out a letter audit to you. Mm-hmm. That letter,
so these numbers don't match. Right. Whenever there's clear numbers not matching, they always question it.
Right. But the letter audit actually does the tax return for you. Their software does the tax return, assumes you should have pay taxes on the full $100,000, not the $30,000, imposes the taxes you owe and the penalty on top of that, and they write it in a very threatening letter format. So when you first get one, if you're not prepared for it, you're going to be scared.
Yeah.
Now when my clients get them, like, oh, yeah, you told me I was getting one here. What do I do with this?
And when people hear this, they are... Some people are worried, oh, you must be kind of bending the rules or skirting this thing or that thing, and it's kind of shady what you're doing. No, it's actually a failing on their ability to properly track IRA transactions. Unfortunately, they don't have enough boxes to check on the 1099s and also the paperwork that gets sent from the IRA custodians to the IRS. There's not enough of those options available for them for us to describe what went on officially with their forms. They just have these gaps in what the forms information contain, and we're doing something that's totally within the rules and isn't bending them in any way and is not skirting the law or shady in any way. It's just their forms don't have all the choices we even need to describe what we're doing. So they're going to, by default, flag it as these numbers don't match. You reported $30,000 to be taxed. We believe from your 1099 it should be $100,000. What's up with the $70,000? We're going to assume you made a clerical error and this is how much tax you owe. Prove us wrong.
And that's where having the letter of instruction can come in handy. It helps in your exhibits because you can say, look at exhibit one. You can see my letter of instruction to the custodian authorizing this. I've also attached a copy of the statement showing that money being put into the IRA. As a 60-day rollover, you'll see the date of receipt of that money into my IRA is well within the 60-day time frame of when constructive receipt of that money was received by me, yada, yada, yada. You can get an idea, folks, of how you handle that letter audit. And if you're going to try this strategy, and again, listen to the November 21st show. We're not going to rehash it today. This man's questions are on the letter of instructions. Listen to that show, and you will follow how the strategy works and how the letter of instruction is supposed to work. But he follows, because he has sent us two questions. The first one, shouldn't we have said 2018, not 2017?
Probably.
Probably. Very well. Next question. Even with the detailed letter of instruction going to the custodian, have you ever had them mess up their records nevertheless?
Yes.
All the time.
But that's where the cover your butt with the letter of instruction comes in. You don't have to argue with the custodian. You just refer them back to the letter they received and say, right, this letter clearly described my intent, what I was trying to have you do. It didn't work that way in your systems. Please correct it so it follows my letter.
Exactly. And then he continues. Isn't it important to review account statements, 1099s, 5498s, to be sure they appropriately recharacterized the transactions? Absolutely, George. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was saying. The letter of instruction is really just to CYA you, not necessarily the custodian, but it serves a second task, as Chris just said. It points out to the custodian what you want to do. So the letter of instruction can help in two realms, but you absolutely still need to save the 1099, the 5498. You have to save. I often tell my clients to save the statement that shows the money movement. Save the statement that shows the money coming out of the IRA. Save the statement, Chris, that shows the money going back into the IRA. Those are all time-stamped on the statement. And if you're within that 60-day period, technically speaking, you have 60 days from the date you got constructive receipt of the money, not 60 days from the date on the statement. Mm-hmm. But if you are within the 60 days just on the statements, then it's a no-brainer.
Yep.
You made the 60-day time limit.
Yep.
So I do agree with him, this listener from Virginia, that it is important to actually save everything. I tell my clients, go into this with the assumption you will receive a letter audit, and you will receive it 2 to 3 years after this was done. You will not receive it the first year. I've never seen one that fast.
No.
It's always been year two or year three. And again, the letter audits will have already tried, convicted, and sentenced you right in that letter. It's only on the second, third, or fourth page, and I jokingly say 8-point font buried at the bottom, is there a little checkbox I hereby dispute, and then you attach your findings. You will never hear from the IRS again if you have very good records on this. You mail the letter audit in, you mail all your support documentation, and someone will get that in. They sit there all day. They look at the letter audit. They look at all your evidence, I guess you could say, and then they'll make a determination if they believe you or not. Every letter audit we have ever helped our clients with, they've always won. I don't know if they win, but it's always been accepted.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good question on the letter of instruction. We highly recommend it. Is it required? No. Not at all, because the forms from the custodian will have a checkbox where you're checking, this is a rollover, this is a conversion, this is a recharacterization. I prefer the letter of instruction. I tend to be wordy. You may not have noticed that, Chris.
No, it's a shock.
No, people, it's like my middle name is Mr. Pithy. But I prefer when I do this to give as much instruction to the custodians as possible, because they do muff up. Mm-hmm. Okay. Perfect. Anyways, that was that question.
Good. I'm glad that topic was so interesting to people.
Yeah, it's making its rounds.
We always
out there.
Know when there's a lot of action on a topic because we start to get a lot of questions on that topic.
We do. This is like the second
which
or
is,
third question.
I think why we get so many Social Security questions is people are really interested in it and confused by it. So,
speaking of which, this is talk about pithy. Look at that.
Oh, nice.
That's got to be the shortest email question we ever had.
I think that's true.
I mean,
a short sentence.
This is tiny. it's from a Californian.
A Californian?
Californian.
Do they live in the north? It's, I mean, what's...
Well, I think they call themselves Californians.
Yes, they probably do.
Yes. Okay. Well, this is from a George from California. If you keep working until age 70, mm-hmm. will the earnings you receive change in any way your PIA?
Possibly. This is one of those maybe kind of answers. The good news is any earnings you have...
Could I interrupt?
Sure.
Could you explain to those less informed what PIA is?
I'm getting there.
Oh, I didn't know you were going to get there. All right. Good. Okay. Very good. Okay. Never mind. I'll sit Thanks. Here and shut up like I normally do.
Okay, just suck on your throat lozenge.
I know. Thank
okay.
you.
So when you turn 62, that is when your PIA or primary insurance amount is determined. That PIA can go up because of earnings after your age of 62, which would include earnings all the way to 70. But none of your earnings after 62, even if they are zero, can make your PIA go down. So essentially what happens is you have this line in the sand drawn where your PIA can be no worse than the amount they calculate when you turn 62. And this is just the way the calculation is done for Social Security. They determine your full retirement age benefit for retirement benefits when you become first eligible to receive those benefits, and that benefit age is 62. You don't receive your full benefit. Another topic, most people realize if you claim that early, you're going to have a reduced benefit. But your PIA, which is the number that determines all benefits regarding your record, is set when you turn 62. Any earnings after that, at age 63, 64, 65, actually the year after you turn 62 while you're still 62, 70, 75, earnings at 90, all get recorded with Social Security. And if they are substantial enough to replace a lower earnings year, technically what's called a lower indexed earnings year, because all these earnings are adjusted into dollars equivalent at the year you turn 62. So we adjust things for wage inflation so that earnings from 1985 are properly adjusted and can be compared to earnings from 2018. Social Security adjusts everything into the dollars equivalent at the year you turn 62. And so it is possible, especially if you keep your full-time career after age 62, that you'll have some earnings years that replace maybe a year you only worked half a year or a low earnings year as you worked in a part-time job, or who knows the reason why you might have it. But if your top 35 years, if one of those isn't very substantial, and we see this happen a lot with people that have zeros, if they took some time off, maybe to raise a family or to volunteer and be in the Peace Corps, you know, who knows why they would have a gap in their earnings history. But some people that have a lot of zeros might have some of those zero years included in their best 35, which is what goes into determining your PIA. Working additionally after 62 up to 70 or beyond may very well increase your PIA, but nothing will decrease it. Nothing as far as your earnings choices go. So if you quit your job right after you turn 62, that fact alone will not reduce your Social Security. Some people believe they're trapped into working. They have to continue to work because they don't want to have those zeros included in their calculation. Well, they're not. Anything after 62, they will consider if it helps you, but will ignore if it were to hurt you. So there's kind of a long answer to their short question. Are you paying attention, Jim? I'm done.
You're done. Excellent. I like that.
He's on to reading other questions. So
I was literally trying to figure out which one I'm going to do.
Yeah. It's all good. This is what happens when you don't have a producer. See, normally a producer would be reading these, serving them up to us on a computer screen, saying, here's the next one to answer.
We don't have that.
No, we don't have any of that. I have to bring my own coffee, warm it up myself in the microwave.
Yeah, same thing with mine here. I didn't go to Starbucks today.
Sounds so sad.
It was. I'm so used to my Starbucks. I tried their juniper latte. Can't say I'm a fan. I gave it two shots. I mean,
do
two
like,
tries.
Do you like gin?
Well, that you know, my friend Blondie came out. Well, Blondie, her name's Lisa. She came out with me. We were grabbing lunch, and then I went over and picked up my juniper. And she says, "What do you got?" I said, "Oh, juniper latte." So I let her take a sip. And she gets this face, and she says, "Let me try that again." She tries it again. She gets this face. She says, "I've had that. I can't pin it." I said, "It's gin." And that's when she said, "Oh, yeah."
Yeah. I'm not a fan already. I'm not even going to taste it. I know I'll hate it.
You don't like gin?
I hate gin. I don't know what it is. That juniper berry taste is terrible.
See, I don't mind gin. My father's favorite drink when he was a younger man was gin and tonic.
Mm. More power to him.
More power to him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if he drinks that anymore. He's 85. But anyway, so Starbucks had a juniper latte. Mm. I tried it twice last week. Just the taste just didn't. Mm.
Okay.
One of the few times I've gotten something from Starbucks that I did not like. Mm. Okay, well, we have about 14 more emails to get to, which we won't today. So let's get to this one. It's not a Social Security question. It is a 401k question.
Okay.
I'm 43. Mm-hmm. I wish I was 43. But anyways, I'm 43. And plan to retire in a couple of months after my 55th birthday. Oh, retire a couple of months after, not
oh,
in.
Okay. I was going to say, the math isn't working there.
Okay, I'm 43.
So in about 12 years, he's yes. going to retire.
I'm 43 and plan to retire a couple of months after my 55th birthday. Mm-hmm. I expect to be able to fund the 5 years between age 55 and age 60 entirely from my 401k.
Okay.
However, what if I were to be laid off after the age of 50 and had to seek another job? Would a custodian-to-custodian transfer of my 401k to my new employer's 401k interview with my ability to retire at 55 and access that 401k balance?
I think he meant interfere, not interview, but his plan is to take advantage.
He definitely meant interfere because that's what he wrote. Did I say interview?
Your mouth said interview, but I'm glad he was straightforward.
Yeah, he got it right. I got it wrong.
Yeah, okay, I'm just making sure.
So he's got a bunch of little moving parts here that I want to try to put his mind at ease first and then explain to our listeners what he's talking about for those who don't understand. First thing, listener, there's no guarantee in 12 years when you're going to retire. The current law that we are going to discuss right now is even going to be around. I can all but assure you laws, rules will have changed by then. But let's just assume nothing changes.
Okay.
He is trying to withdraw money under the age 55 exemption to the 10% early withdrawal penalty.
Yep.
That's what he's coming down to. He knows in his mind he's going to retire just a few months after the age of 55. Under current laws, and again, we don't know where they're going to be in 12 years, but under current laws, anyone who removes money from a 401k or an IRA prior to reaching age 59 and a half will have to pay a 10% surtax. We call it the 10% early withdrawal penalty. A 10% surtax on all monies removed from the 401k. So he's sitting there wondering, well, gee, what if I get laid off before turning 55 and retiring? He's going to retire a few months after he turns 55. What if I get laid off? And he's anticipating, I guess, being laid. He's only 43 now, but he references age 50. What if I get laid off after age 50, but before 55? Mm-hmm. All the money he needs to live on, Chris, is in that 401k.
Got it.
But he's anticipating if he gets laid off around age 50, 51, 52, 53, he's going to have to go back to work because he doesn't have enough money to retire until 55.
Right.
And now the rule to be exempted from the 10% early withdrawal penalty is you withdraw money from your current employers. Well, most current employer, the employer you retired from, when you separate from service in or after the year you turn 55.
Right.
So now he's recognizing this may not work.
Right. What if he has a forced separation from service at 50, but he's thinking, making a plan, I guess, and saying, well, what if I get a new employer, I go to work again, and they have a 401k, can I move my 401k from the employer where I was laid off into the new employer's 401k and then still take advantage of the age 55 rule on all of that money, even though some of it came from that prior employer?
And the answer to that is absolutely.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a couple of caveats, as always, that he has to be careful of. You must move the money before getting laid off. Very few 401ks will allow you, before retiring, very few 401ks will allow you to move another 401k into it if you are no longer an active participant in the plan. You're still kind of a participant in the plan because it's there. Yeah. You're not quote-unquote active. You're not actively putting money in. You're not still employed. You are a retired participant.
In other words, he's going to need to move the money over there after he gets the job there. He shouldn't wait until after he retires from that second employer and then try to shove money in. It'll be too late in most cases.
So when you get laid, or if you get laid off, and he's just randomly chose age 50, but let's just assume he does get laid off at 50. Now all the money that you wanted to access between 55 and 60 is in a 401k that will no longer be eligible for an exemption from the 10% early withdrawal penalty. For one main reason, you separated from service before the year you turned 55. You're only 50. Now, if you are a public sector, a first responder, if you are a first responder or emergency responder, you have the same benefit as us who do not do that as a living, but it's age 50, not 55. So in his example, if he was a fireman, say, he would have a workaround because he's only 50.
As long as he made it to 50.
As long as he made it to 50. But yes, you are allowed, listener, to move the money from the 401k you got laid off at. You can move that money to your new employer's 401k, assuming they accept transfers.
Not all do.
Not all do. It's rare to find one that doesn't.
Right. Most do.
Because the more money in the plan, the more money that the custodians get.
Yeah.
So they want to be able to allow that. But the transfers in really come down not only to what the custodian and the third-party administrator, the TPA, can handle. It also comes down to if the 401k itself allows that, and that will be established by the 401k board of the company sponsoring it. So for one reason or another, maybe they exempted it. But it's very rare that I ever find a 401k that will not accept money being moved in, as long as you are an active employee and working there. But if you retire and then try to move money in, a lot of 401ks say no, you can't do it, and they won't accept it. So I would just want to make sure when you get the new job, you simply move your old employer's 401k where you just got laid off from, you move that 401k into your new 401k. You could also move it to an IRA and then from the IRA move it to the new 401k. Those rules are allowed. In the past, you couldn't do that. It was more of a pain. I won't bore you with it, but you don't have to worry about any of that anymore. Remember the years of conduit IRAs?
Yeah.
Those were just a pain. So those days are over, but however you want to do it, you can move the money in. And then if you separate from service in the year you turn 55, you don't have to be 55 yet. You could be 54. But as long as you lose your job in the year that you were going to turn 54 to 55, even though you get laid off at 54, you are still eligible to remove money from that employer's 401k and that employer's 401k only and avoid the 10% early withdrawal penalty.
Yep.
But you are also allowed by the IRS to move money into that 401k from otherwise taxable accounts, tax-deferred accounts, rather, and access it under this rule of 55. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yep.
In fact, we've talked in the past about a strategy to separate basis, because you can move money from an IRA into a 401k, except you cannot transfer after-tax IRA money into a 401k. So it's a wonderful way to remove basis from a IRA and allow you to do a tax-free Roth conversion. Those are always sweet. So it is strategies we've done a lot here at the office, but yes, you are allowed to move other IRAs and other 401ks into that employer's 401k. And I would say that's a perfect retirement planning strategy for early retirees. If you've got all your money tied up, say, in an IRA, and you know you're going to have to debit said IRA when you retire, and you're going to retire in or after the year you turn 55, but you're not quite 59 and a half, I would say move the money from the IRA into the 401k, or at least the money you're going to need for 5 years. He's trying to get to age 60. As we all know, it's actually age 59 and a half. But once you reach 59 and a half, you can take out money without the 10% penalty, and this whole strategy becomes moot at that point.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
Anything else you want to add to that?
I don't think so.
Well,
that's a good question.
Easy.
Yeah.
Okay, back to Social Security. Oh, you're going to say I have
305,
to
just so you know.
305?
Right now it's 305.
I'm going to make a call at 3. Well, I can read the question, you can answer, and then wrap up.
Okay, perfect.
Sounds
so shoot
good.
One out, and then you can excuse yourself, and I'll say all kinds of...
You're going to talk all sorts of stuff about me, yeah.
All sorts of flattering things about you while you're gone.
I'm sure you will. All right, well, this Social Security question... I'll let you attack it. It's not a Social Security question in as much it is a financial planning question involving Social Security.
Okay.
So it's not going to rely on your expertise as a Social Security guru. It's going to rely on the C, the F, and the P after your name.
I see.
Okay. Another Californian.
Nice.
Wow. Seems to be Georgia and California.
A lot of people in those two states.
Well, especially California. Aren't they the most populous state, or is Texas?
No, it's California, to my knowledge.
California?
Yeah. I think it's not even close. California's huge and has a lot of big
cities.
Well,
Texas is a pretty damn big state, too.
True, but there's a lot of people in those big cities in California.
Okay, so it begins. First of all, I would like to thank you and Jim for the podcast.
So I'm first and you're the
You apparently
sidekick?
Are first here.
Excellent. I like the question already.
Clearly, this Californian has been shaking a little bit too much in those earthquakes and fires. It's supposed to be Jim and Chris. Okay. First of all, I would like to thank you, I guess that's you, and Jim for the podcast. Also, Chris, I really enjoy your Social Security blog. Great info.
Oh.
So nice little kudos out to you. My question pertains to Social Security planning. Almost all of the advice out there is based on the man being older than the woman and being the primary breadwinner. That's because most men marry women younger than them, I guess. I don't know.
Historically, that's been true. Some of that's changing a little
bit. In his case, it's changing, and that's what his question is. Mm-hmm. In my case, I think we agree that waiting to at least 66 to claim your benefit is a no-brainer. But what if the male is 7 years younger than the woman and also the primary breadwinner? Then I believe the claiming strategy is not so clear, especially if there is no history of longevity on either side. I can't be the only one who is this situation. Maybe you could discuss the different things someone in my position should consider on your podcast or EDU show. If not, could Chris make it a blog post? I think you should make it a blog post anyway. Just in case you care, and we always care. I think he meant just in case you need the info. I'm 56. My wife is 63. I will collect $2,900 at my full retirement age. She will receive $1,200 if she were to claim her benefit right now at 63. Okay. So what he's essentially saying, if you look at the timing, his wife is 7 years older than him. Women on average live about 7 years longer than men. So he's saying neither one of us have longevity. He didn't get into his medical issues, but or if he has any, but he said both of us do not have longevity, essentially. I'm 7 years younger than her. She's 7 years older than me. We're probably going to pass away together. Should the higher breadwinner still wait to age 70? Or in his case, should we even wait to our full retirement age of 66? Or should he claim earlier? I think that's what he's getting at. Should we claim even earlier? And he is getting into the mortality that they're both going to happen at the same time. And death may happen around the same time because of the age difference and the fact that men will pass away sooner than women. So it's an intriguing question. And to me, and I'll let you take it over, but to me, there's a lot of good financial planning moving parts to this that one would have to consider. But anyways, folks, I literally am running late for a phone call, so I have to go take a call. Chris is going to wrap up the rest of the show. I do want to thank everyone. He will give his fine answer, I'm sure, and I will be back next week on this Q&A. And I think later on today we'll record the EDU show.
Sounds good. Well, thanks, Jim. Why don't you hand me the question, though, just in case I need to reference anything I didn't jot down in my notes here. We have old-fashioned paper here. It's kind of nice. It makes it easy to hand across the desk or table. We have this big old conference table-looking thing that we've turned into a recording studio. So anyway, so this is a little bit out of the ordinary, of course. We do have quite a few cases we run across where one spouse is 7 years younger than the other. That's not particularly uncommon, although I'd say just from anecdotal evidence, the most common situation is for the spouses to be within 2 or 3 years of one another, with typically the male being older. That's just a societal norm that's been happening here for centuries, Western civilization, I guess you could say. And so in this case, the 7-year difference is not particularly shocking. We run across that a lot, but it's usually the older spouse of the two, whether it's male or female, it's usually the older one that financially has done better for themselves and as far as earnings go over their earnings life and has the higher Social Security benefit. So this George, this listener in this case, is describing a situation that is fairly rare, one that the female is older and significantly older, 7 years, but the younger spouse, George in this case, rather than Georgette, we'll call her, has a substantially higher, about a double, roughly, the benefit that his older wife has. So a few things. One thing it does equalize, even though there's this big age difference, it's going to equalize somewhat the period of time of that there'll be just one spouse left. Now, that's just talking averages. We don't know this particular couple, which one's going to die first, and it could be any time, technically. So there could be a very big difference between the two. When Jim talks about how we discuss frequently how one spouse, usually the higher wage earner, is encouraged, all else being equal, encouraged when possible to delay claiming to 70. The reason for that is very clear in that when one dies, one spouse dies, the surviving spouse only gets to receive one of the two Social Security benefits and the higher of the two. So you want to have that one remaining Social Security benefit be as large as possible. Well, that's going to be him in this case, but if he delays till 70, she's going to be 77 at that time when he turns on his benefits. So they'll have lived. She's going to be fairly old before they start to receive any benefits from his Social Security. So then, from a stepping back and more of a financial planning aspect, I think this couple in particular really begs, the situation begs for a bit of an analysis of what type of income they need to be combined income in the forms of things like Social Security or other sources of income like pensions and annuities if they have any, etc., to be combined with their other financial assets to make their retirement go the way they want. Social Security is unique in that it is quite predictable, even though people always talk about how precarious the funding is. The chances of that going away or being substantially decreased for people of this age group is very low, even though our legislators are going to have to adjust some things with Social Security for its longevity. The chances that someone who's already in their mid to late 50s or 60s, as in the case here, that something changes that drastically undermines what they would have gotten from Social Security, I believe is quite low. Usually we see major changes to programs like Social Security get kind of phased in over time and affect younger people who have time to adjust to the new rules. They don't try to pull the rug out from under people who are already approaching or in retirement age. So I think they're going to be under the current funding model, and but whether they need to rely on that one remaining Social Security benefit if one of the two of them passes away is dependent upon a lot of other things. We deal with a lot of Social Security rules issues here. Jim was right in that this is more of a financial planning question as much as it is a Social Security question. From a Social Security standpoint, just from a rule standpoint, right now, if she were to claim, or even for the next 6 years until he turns 62, the only benefit available to her and to the family between the two of them is for her to claim her own benefit, which he mentioned was about $1,200 a month right now at her age 63. If she delayed, it would be a little bit higher than that. But if they wanted to turn on something now to supplement their lifestyle, it would be $1,200 a month. She has no right to a spousal benefit at this point because he hasn't reached his age of first eligibility, which is going to be when he turns 62. Once he turns 62, she actually, not only would he have to turn 62, but he'll have to claim his benefit. If that happens, she would then be eligible to receive a spousal benefit if the spousal benefit exceeds what she is claiming. From the looks of it, looking at the numbers, just the half of his benefit and all of her benefit are actually fairly close to one another. So she may or may not get a slight raise, if you will, if you want to consider it that, when he turns 62 and claims his benefit in my hypothetical. So she might eventually have the ability to receive some benefit from claiming a spousal benefit, but she has a modest, average Social Security benefit created for herself, so she may not really get much from a spousal situation. So then the question becomes, should he claim at 62, 63, all the way up to 70? So the question is really, in that 8 years, 62 to 70, where should he claim? That's where the financial planning part's going to come in. It's going to depend upon whether they need this lifetime secure income flow as a substantial and key portion of their overall income needs in retirement, or if they have substantially other assets that they're going to be relying upon. This is just one piece of the whole story. So I couldn't sit here and say, yes, he should claim at 62 or 66 or 67 or 70 or any of those in between without knowing more of their full situation. All we can comment now is the rules as it applies to each of those ages. Right now, only she can claim her own benefit. When he claims, it will open the door to her receiving some benefit from her spousal benefit, but looking at the numbers, probably isn't going to be a whole lot. If they need to have secure inflation-adjusted income left over of substantial amount because they don't have a lot of other assets, it might be well worth considering getting him to delay as late as possible. In this case, it may very well be him who is left behind because she is 7 years older. It is true that females live longer than men, so some of that differential is going to be offset by the age difference there. But the fact is, she is older than he is, and it's, you know, one of the two of them is likely to be left behind for some period of time, and one of the two benefits will disappear. So there still might be a case to be made for him delaying to 70, but it wouldn't be so much a Social Security question as it would be, what does their entire financial situation look like? Now, our general approach, not to delve too far into the specifics of how we approach this, but usually we try to match like for like things. If you've got specific expenses that are fixed through your lifetime and must be met no matter what, we usually like to rely upon funding or income for those that's of the same description. Lifetime income that's always going to be there to meet those lifetime expenses that are always going to be there. So Social Security is one of those things that can contribute to those secure income needs, if you will. If you have a good balance there, then you'll have like for like secure income that goes to fixed and required expenses. And then other assets that could be dipped into, if you will, to fund the more variable or discretionary expenses, what we call the, you know, the fun things in life that add to your enjoyment of life overall, but in a year of necessity could be cut back or delayed or something like that. Those, we usually tend not to recommend you fund those things with secure income like Social Security or pensions or that sort of thing. But again, it depends on your financial situation, what your needs are, what the balance is between your required needs and your fun needs, if you will. And so that's kind of how we'd approach it. So I'd encourage to bring this around to the beginning, I would encourage the two of them to really, they're old enough now where they are close enough to retirement where they can have a good idea of what they want to do in retirement, what they have to meet as far as fixed expenses in the form of medical and food and gasoline and housing and things like that. They can look at all their financial resources to include Social Security and then figure out where Social Security will fit into that entire story. And that will provide them some guidance as to when would be the optimal time for him to claim his Social Security benefit. I suspect it would make sense for her to claim relatively soon, to have some of that income start immediately. Because remember, when one of them dies, one of those goes away. So that's why it's usually not recommended. If we look at the statistics behind the situation, it's usually not beneficial for both people to delay to 70. So I would suspect that any old time is good for her to file. And then the real big question is going to be, when should he file? That bigger benefit he's got, how would that most optimally fit into their entire financial situation? So thanks, everybody, for listening. I'll sign off for Jim and I both. Jim usually signs off at the end because he likes to. But we are living, breathing, actual financial planners here in the state of Colorado. We service clients all over the country, though, due to the gloriousness of the internet and phone lines, if you will. And so if you would like some information or some additional guidance as to what we might be able to do for your situation, we don't require that you invest with us, although we do have that as part of our services here. But so there's, unlike most financial advisors that won't talk to you in any great detail unless you agree to move over your portfolio for them to manage and harvest some sorts of management fees for such, we package up our financial advice separately. Kind of an a la carte basis, if you will. We have many different things that we can help you with. Tax questions, Social Security questions, retirement income questions, 401k decisions, all kinds of things like that. And we can talk about what we can help you with during what we call a coffee and a second opinion. If you go to the website jimhelps.com, you'll see a contact form there. You can even directly schedule one of these phone meetings. Be happy to talk to you for a short period of time, and you can describe what your needs might be. We can tell you how we might be able to help you or not help you. And if that's the case, we'll certainly try to direct you to the right place. So thanks a lot for joining us this week here on the Retirement and IRA Show. And we'll be back with you next week with a brand new Q&A show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.